From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We meet here in an hour of grief and challenge. Dag Hammarskjöld is dead, but the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda.
That was then President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, 54 years ago next Friday on September 25th, 1961, eulogizing the deceased Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was killed in a plane crash 1 week earlier. This news report from that time is emblematic of the contemporaneous Western media coverage of the Secretary General's death.
The United Nations in New York, on the eve of the opening of its 16th Assembly session, is plunged into mourning upon the passing of Dag Hammarskjöld. More than 8 years ago, on April 14, 1953, he had assumed his difficult post as the successor to Trygve Lie. The serious, quietly courageous Swedish diplomat was to bring new stature to the job of Chief Administrative Officer of the UN. And in his quest for peace, he met death. In mournful tribute, the flags of the member nations are removed from their poles in front of the world headquarters, even while the first impacts are felt in far-flung capitals of the globe. Hammarskjöld's death in the line of duty could rock the very foundations of the UN. A lone UN banner flies at half-staff as saddened colleagues gather at a news conference to make the official announcement of the Secretary General's death in the wilds of Central Africa. He was en route to peace talks with Katanga President Moshe Shombe when he perished in the crash of the plane flying him from Leopoldville, the Congo, to Ndola, northern Rhodesia.
But in the years following, a quite different story has emerged, one that resonates with the facts of the historical context of the then and still raging battle for control of the resources of Africa. We spoke about that with Professor Gerald Horn via Skype from Houston Friday. Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us on this anniversary of the death of Dag Hammarskjöld in the midst of the Congo crisis.
Thank you for inviting me.
Could you give us a brief history of what happened, just to contextualize his death? Because many thought that perhaps his plane crash was no accident and that his turn towards the government in Congo, at least the negotiations, might have been behind some of the colonial powers inducing his death.
Well, the Scandinavian Secretary General of the United Nations, of course, a predecessor of today's Ban Ki-moon, died tragically in a plane crash, but subsequent investigations have suggested that this may not have been an accident. Not only is it tied perhaps to the Congo crisis that you correctly mentioned, but also the crisis that was then unfolding in the Rhodesias, not only in northern Rhodesia, that is to say Zambia, where a so-called white minority government had been in power, but also with regard to southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where you may recall that in 1965, the European minority made a unilateral declaration of independence in order to effectuate so-called sovereignty and escape the logic of African majority rule, of one person, one vote. This led to a war, but it was a crisis that was also brewing at the time of Dag Hammarskjöld's death, and that's not even to get into the question of the big enchilada, that is to say South Africa, and the fact that South Africa was quite concerned about moves towards African independence all over the continent and had a bone to pick with the United Nations, because the United Nations had been clamoring against apartheid ever since it came into existence with the 1948 elections in South Africa. And of course, I would like to scrutinize the records of the U.S. authorities, who had been in bed with the South African authorities ever since 1948, certainly before 1948, and might have had a reason to get rid of Dag Hammarskjöld.
The plane came down in one of the Rhodesias, right? And with all of that in play, I mean, the entire continent of Africa was in play. There had been liberation movements that were brewing in the post-war period, even before, but that really started maturing in the post-war period and actualizing in the late 50s and early 60s. So the context is certainly one of volatility. Do you see how things played out in Congo afterwards as having been affected by Dag Hammarskjöld's death?
Well, you know that contemporaneously there was the assassination, tragically, of Patrice Lumumba, the leader of independent Congo, that takes place in the early stages of the JFK, the John F. Kennedy administration. This sets the stage for the rise of Joseph Mobutu, Mobutu Sese Seko, who, of course, reigns in Congo for the next few decades before he's toppled and replaced by Laurent Kabila, and then, of course, the Mr. Kabila's son, who is still in power. Congo, as you well know, is a treasure house of natural resources. It has been plagued and tormented by European colonial powers, at least since the bad old days of the African slave trade. And since that time, has been viewed as a major prize. And in that context, it's not surprising that questions would be raised about Dag Hammarskjöld's death, because the context is also the Cold War. That is to say, the contestation between Moscow and Washington, with Washington taking the point of view that anti-colonialism was a communist plot, that moves towards African sovereignty and independence or a communist plot. And of course, it's well known that the Soviets did support the African liberation struggles. Of course, the university in Moscow, Patrice Lumumba University, that trained a generation of African leaders, was named precisely after the Congolese leader, Patrice Lumumba, which too helped to inflame Washington. So this is the overriding context for this investigation unfolding of the death of the Secretary General of the United Nations.
We have coming up next week the general debate at the United Nations, and we have most likely the head of the African Union, President Mugabe, coming to speak there. What do you think he might have to say about what's happening in Africa with the installation of AFRICOM all over the continent, and even as Congo continues to burn?
Well, pardon the expression, but Robert Mugabe is the bête noir, the antagonist, if you like, of the North Atlantic powers, and of course that would also include Australia and New Zealand as well, not least because he and his party, ZANU-PF, helped to expropriate the land of European farmers, and this caused outrage in the North Atlantic countries and Australia, because of course, if you look at the United States, this country basically rests upon stolen land, and when Europeans are pushed out of stolen land, this causes alarm bells to go off in Washington. Since the fact that Mr. Mugabe was elected president of the African Union suggests that the Africans did not have a necessary particular problem with that expropriation, and I dare say that at the United Nations rostrum, Mr. Mugabe will continue to rail against the North Atlantic powers. He will probably signal his sympathy for the People's Republic of China, which, of course, has helped to keep Zimbabwe afloat. And, of course, the rise of the People's Republic of China has provided a countervailing force to the domination of the North Atlantic powers, which is also of concern, which is one of the reasons why you hear so much blather and propaganda about China as the new colonialists, because, of course, the French in particular are quite concerned that their playgrounds in Africa might be challenged. Of course, the most recent evidence of that is the coup in Burkina Faso within the last 24, 48 hours, where this former French colony, where Paris still plays a dominant role, just endured a military coup engineered by forces that are very close to Paris. So I'm sure that this will bring the spotlight upon the rostrum when Mr. Mugabe begins to speak.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And as we continue our special coverage of the news and events taking place around the world on the eve of next week's opening of the UN General Assembly's general debate, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
And let's start, if it's okay with you, Don, picking up on the issue of Guatemala that we left off last week.
Go for it.
And one of the things that I didn't comment much on last week, because we were trying to link it all into the stuff that was going on in, or is soon to go on in New York in the UN, is the issue of the way this Commission on Impunity, against impunity in Guatemala, has played this very curious role in the whole crisis in Guatemala. In some ways, kind of, it's been at a distance, and in other ways, at key moments, it's kind of played an important part in nudging events in a particular direction, in particular the direction of the prosecution of the vice president and the president. And so, it just seems to me when you look at that, and all the hype around all the corporate media coverage, at least, of events in Guatemala have kind of been along the lines of, oh, this is kind of some major citizen power initiative and it's going to completely change the political scene in Guatemala. Well, I think as events are progressing, we can see that that's not the case. And in last week's program, I mistakenly said that I thought the Commission for Against Impunity in Guatemala had been set up under the previous government of Álvaro Colom. In fact, it wasn't. It dates from 2006. I hadn't realized that. It's actually quite a well-established UN body in Guatemala. And in fact, one of the reasons that went against Otto Perez, the president who's just been forced to resign, was that he wanted to close down that UN commission in May, and came under pressure from the United States in particular not to do so, and of course from the UN itself. And it just seems to me that's another example of the way the UN can play not an overtly reactionary role in the region, but I remember in 1990 when the United Nations Force for Central America, the mission to Central America, was in Nicaragua, supposedly to stabilize the country. And, you know, it's a question of whether they contributed that to that or not, in my opinion. But at that time, the UN was again a force that protected the Contra and created spaces for the Contra revolution at that time and to create a situation more favorable to the right-wing forces in the country.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, perhaps I'm wrong, but I suspect that as time goes on, we'll see that that has also been the case with this UN commission in Guatemala. And then that's one of the reasons I'm quite surprised to see former president of Honduras, Mel Zelaya, calling for one of these commissions in Honduras. Because I think that UN interventions in a country are generally unhelpful to progressive forces in that country.
Let me just, on that point, it's interesting. Today, Friday the 18th, is the anniversary, the 54th anniversary of the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, the UN Secretary General at the time. And many, after the fact, said that the reason that he died was that he was murdered by the United States and or others for the role that he had played, basically switching sides in Congo, and that this was some sort of abject lesson to future secretaries general that if you go too hard against the interests of the United States, you better walk because your plane's coming down.
Well, yeah, and there's so many examples of that, aren't there? Omar Torrijos in Panama, President Roldos in Ecuador, all the victims of mysterious plane crashes. And then when you contrast the way, you know, when outside interventions happen either via the UN or via some other mechanism, for example, in Haiti, although the UN is involved there, the initial move against the legitimate government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide was by the United States, Canada, and France. And and subsequently the UN installed itself as the occupying power, effectively, in Haiti. And if you look at examples in the region, currently in the region, for example, we've got two processes going on that are very, very important for the stability of the region. The peace process, the peace talks in Havana between the Colombian government of President Juan Manuel Santos and the FARC guerrilla fighters, who have they have been the two main protagonists in Colombia's civil war for 50 years now, since the early 60s. And And what's going on there is that a peace process that has been largely facilitated by regional powers, in particular Venezuela, and thanks to the good offices of Cuba, the negotiations are taking place in Havana. And that process is likely to lead to a very positive outcome, perhaps sooner than we think. And it's even possible that there may be a peaceful settlement inked and declared before Christmas. That's possible. So, and let's hope that is the case, and that the terrible civil war in Colombia that's caused so much suffering to millions of people, because Colombia has something like 6 million displaced people, internally displaced people as a result of the civil war.
Right, and a lot of Colombians here in the United States as a consequence of that too, and I assume in every country between here and there. But, you know, let me ask you what you think of this. It seems that the border issue, both border issues actually, the border issue with Colombia and all that, you know, we have discussed and, you know, that remains to be discussed, and also, you know, on the other side with Guyana, it seems like an attempt to triangulate somebody's way into the discussions that are going on in Havana. What do you think of that?
I'm not sure, Don. It's so difficult. And as outsiders, we only get a tiny percent of the story, don't we? Because what's going on behind the scenes is kind of completely opaque to us. But there may well be some substance to that kind of interpretation. And of course, you're referring to another regional dispute that has flared up over the last month or so, whereby Venezuela, which is actually a country that has received hundreds of thousands of Colombian refugees, and they've established themselves in Venezuela. And that completely contradicts the corporate media narrative over the last couple of weeks that Venezuela has abused the rights of Colombians along the Colombian-Venezuelan frontier. But that dispute is also being mediated by a regional body, in this case the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR. And I think it's right to say that there's a tension or a conflict or an opposition between the United States, which is trying to sustain its role, the role that it's played certainly since 1948. There have been a few military interventions direct interventions by United States military in the region, but nothing like what happened before the Second World War. And you can see the way U.S. policy, the techniques, the tactics of U.S. policy have changed over the last 20, 30 years, perhaps. But the ultimate strategy remains the same that it's always been, to promote the interests of U.S. corporations and promote U.S. political influence in the region in its favor, against the best interests of the impoverished majority in the region. That's true around the world, isn't it? Yeah. So there's a tension between that long-term, unchanging strategy and these new initiatives, these new regional initiatives, whereby the nations of South America, the nations of Central America, the Caribbean countries combine together in order to defend their interests. And I think it's certainly right to say, and it's obviously right to say, it seems to me, that the U.S. influence over Guyana is what is stoking that territorial conflict between Guyana and Venezuela. And I don't think that the United States want to see a peaceful settlement in Colombia, because it's their intervention in Colombia has been extremely lucrative for both the U.S. corporations in terms of mining and oil and those kind of raw material extractions, and also in terms of support for the U.S. military and security complex, if you want to call it that, and who have made a lot of money. The arms industry in the United States has made a lot of money from the civil war in Colombia. And I was reading an article from 2013 in the Washington Post where it says that since 2000 up until now, Plan Colombia, this plan to supposedly clamp down on the narcotics activity and help the Colombian government win the civil war. It's done precisely the opposite. It's nurtured the narco paramilitary drugs industry in Colombia, largely under former president, then President Álvaro Uribe, now former President Álvaro Uribe, and it's also deliberately, almost deliberately failed to end the civil war. And so, and that's been of huge benefit to all kinds of sinister interests in the United States corporate sector and in the United States government, especially in the intelligence sector, of course.
Well, you know, look at that. If you look at that around the region, you know, to start at Mexico and work your way down, everywhere that the United States is involved in the so-called drug war, you have this kind of paramilitary slash mafia military activity with the armaments, by the way, that say made in USA.
Yeah, and Mexico has its Plan Merida, doesn't it? Plan Merida was modeled on Plan Colombia.
Yep.
And so I'm sure there are people in the United States who are far more knowledgeable than me about the kind of the domestic political side of how those policies are developed and the reasons that they're developed for the benefit of internal actors in the United States.
Were that true. Unfortunately, they're not. What they're aware of is what Donald Trump said yesterday.
And what's the latest Trumpism?
Beats the hell out of me. I have no idea, and I have no interest.
Right. Yeah, Donald Trump is a perfect example of kind of attitudes, of reactionary kind of Neanderthal attitudes in the United States about the United States' contemporary relationship with Latin America and the Caribbean. It seems to me that the United States is slowly losing its long strategic campaign to protect corporate interests and defend U.S. interests.
Yeah, it doesn't
U.S. stop government them, interests.
It doesn't stop them from playing the same game. Let's jump to the other side of Venezuela, to Guyana. The situation is that this year, while this suddenly became hot, It comes along with a change in the control of the government from the PPP to the APNU-AFC. The voting for the new government this year that put basically a U.S. puppet in control of Guyana broke down...
Yeah, David Granger, right?
Exactly. Broke down 49.93% in favor of Granger's party and 49.26% in favor of the party that had held power before, which was a leftist government. The election itself was called based on a vote of no confidence after the president, the former president, who had decided to veto some spending cuts that were forced on him by the opposition in the National Assembly, that's Donald Ramatar. He vetoed a bunch of spending cuts that would have hurt the people. And so they had a no-confidence vote in him, and he dissolved the National Assembly and called new elections. And in those new elections, that's how it broke. Suddenly the United States is in the driver's seat. But you see that the population there is about evenly divided, like it is in places like Brazil and Argentina, even more so in Guyana, and they're playing it. They're working it, and the minute that they get a lever of power in Guyana, there's suddenly a military problem with the adjoining Venezuela.
Yeah, perhaps it's worth noting in that context that Trinidad and Tobago recently had their election, and a center-left party just managed to squeeze in, and I think the vote there was also very close. But they managed to win the election against a party much more favorable to the policies of the United States. Let's see how Trinidad and Tobago's policy develops over the next while. They've resisted Venezuelan influence in the region under their previous government. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. So, yeah, and the United States has been able, and as we've said in previous programs, to take advantage of colonial legacies like the territorial anomaly between Guatemala and Venezuela, which dates back again to the 19th century, like so many of these disputes, doesn't it? And Bolivia, and there are events going on, perhaps we should shift to events elsewhere. Bolivia now is... hoping that the International Court of Justice in The Hague will declare that it does have competence to and jurisdiction over the dispute that Bolivia has with Chile, that also dates from the 19th century, when a war in the 1873 or whenever it was left Bolivia landlocked because Chile conquered the strip of land that gave Bolivia access to the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. And in that context, too, in Bolivia, it's very interesting to see that there's a very strong movement, the grassroots movement, to change the constitution to allow Evo Morales to stand for re-election for another presidential term.
I'm in favor of that.
So there's that going on. And then you mentioned Argentina. In Argentina, something very interesting happened. Again, I think this is a sign of the way the United States is desperately pulling all available levers and pressing all available switches to try and sustain its influence in the region. And what's happened in Argentina is that a local court in an area, I think it's called Tucumán, a district of Argentina, a kind of lower court, has declared the recent election there a null and void because it points to two or three ridiculously isolated events that couldn't possibly have affected the overall results. But in the election campaign, apparently in the count, apparently there were these two or three extremely minor infractions of the electoral law that couldn't possibly have affected the outcome, which led to an 11% win by the candidate of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president of Argentina's party. And so that vote has been declared void, and there's a judicial tug of war going on about whether or not that judgment is going to stand or whether or not they're going to have to be new elections. But that's just another example. What the more important point about that judgment is that it was then taken up by Argentina's mainstream press. It's big media, big national media. The national media there is dominated by the right wing, highly concentrated in the hands of a couple of families there. And what they're arguing now is that this just shows that the electoral process can't be trusted, and that even if the elections do take place successfully one way or another later in the year, the result won't be valid. So, and that's another example of the way the United States and its regional allies are trying to undermine legitimate institutional processes in the region.
You don't see, because you're Irish, you don't understand this, or Nicaraguan, or wherever you are in between. Okay, if you were an American, you'd understand this. It's called spreading democracy.
Right. Well, and I think we'll have to hear some views about spreading democracy in the UN over the next few days,
I think so too. I'm looking forward to that. I think there's going to be an awful lot of personally gratifying entertainment, but an awful lot of truth being told from that podium. And we're going to do our best to spread some of that around. Who do you think is going to be the most interesting to listen to?
Well, certainly Vladimir Putin. Right, and Nicolas Maduro. But I think any of the progressive Latin American leaders there are going to be explaining their point of view in a very forthright way, and rejecting continued attempts by the United States and the European Union to sustain neocolonial policies and neocolonial interventions that are essentially against the interests of the majority, especially the impoverished majorities in the countries of Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And I think, and I hope, that we'll get an intervention from President Mugabe or his representative about the situation in Africa.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.